Well, it's good to be back, and let me extend my own welcome along with my brother Yuri. Welcome everyone, and if you're visiting or if you're here for the first or second time, we welcome you, and if you haven't been around for a while, we welcome you back, and it's good to be together this morning in God's house on another lovely fall morning. This is where we ended off last week. This is where Pastor Abby ended up last week, post-Red Sea crossing. And post-Red Sea crossing, there was a lot of singing, there was dancing, there was tambourines. It was a good time. I will sing to the Lord, the song goes, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my might. These are the lyrics they were singing, and it's become my salvation. And we were celebrating deliverance and freedom from enslavement and freedom from oppression and freedom from bondage. And the Lord will reign forever and ever. And that's how the song ended. And we said at the beginning of Exodus, this is our seventh week of 12 in the book of Exodus that we're going through here. And we said at the beginning that if the actual Exodus were all the book of Exodus were about, if Exodus were only about deliverance, we would stop here. We would have stopped there at chapter 15, verse 21. And if we didn't know the story, if we weren't familiar with the story, the next bit may come as a bit of a surprise. The next part may come as a bit of a surprise. And I'm sure it may have come as a bit of a surprise to the ancient Israelites who had just been led up out of Egypt. Because at this point, they might have been thinking, bring on the land flowing with milk and honey, right? Because this is what life is all about, right? Milk and honey. This is what the Christ-following life is all about, right? Going from strength to strength. Every day a Friday, as one church leader put it in a book. Right? Who wouldn't want that every day of Friday? Unless you're working rotating shifts or you work weekends. But we don't have that, friends, in our story. Instead, we have this. And if you want to open your Bibles, I'll be referring to the passage. We have this. Then Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. The wilderness. And the Israelites are going to be in the wilderness for 40 years. They're going to be in the wilderness for multiple generations. And one writer describes the wilderness like this. And listen to this description. It's very good. The experience of order leads immediately into disorder. Freedom becomes anarchy. Into the jaws of the wilderness where demons howl and messiahs are tempted. Where familiar resources are taken away. Lifelessness seems to be the only order on which one can depend. The journey from the Red Sea to the Promised Land is littered with freshly dug graves, and not a single birth is recorded. Wilderness is life beyond redemption. It's beyond redemption, but it's short of consummation. The former seems ineffective, the latter only a mirage. The hope has been proclaimed, but the horizons keep disappearing into the sandstorms. And so trust in God often turns to recalcitrance and resentment. Faith erodes with the dunes. Commandments collapse into the disorder that shapes daily life. This is the wilderness. And this is rather a bleak picture, no? It's a bleak picture. But the thing about the wilderness, friends, is God is with us there. We remember the pillar of fire by night, the pillar of cloud by day that we heard about last week. God is leading us in this wilderness, and God meets us there, and God hears cries for deliverance in the wilderness. And this is important because in the wilderness we face matters of life and death daily. We face matters of life and death. For the Israelites in our story today, they're facing a matter of life and death. They're facing a matter of survival. And matters of life and death are brought into stark relief when we're in the wilderness. when we're in Egypt, living in seeming comfort, but actually being enslaved to something beyond ourselves, matters of life and death can be hard to see. They can be harder to see. But this is the thing about the wilderness. A few weeks ago, we talked about Moses' first wilderness experience. Remember, we talked about Moses when he went back to Egypt with his wife and his two boys. And he went from Midian to Egypt. And we talked about this being a wilderness experience. This was a life and death situation for Moses. Remember, he almost died. He almost died. And we said he was in a liminal situation. He was in a threshold situation. He was in between two places. And we said that the thing about these threshold situations is when we're in between places, this is where transformation happens. This is where we're forced to rely on something outside of ourselves. And so in our story this morning, we have 3 days' journey into the wilderness for the Israelites. We read in the Bible about 3 days in the belly of a great fish. 3 days. Later on, we read about 3 days in a tomb. These are all threshold situations. But in them, transformation happens. And something new takes place. These are the places in which we're forced to look at something beyond ourselves. And our own resources turn out to be pretty meager. We're forced to face our own inability to control things. Our own inability to manage things. And it's little wonder, I think, in our Bible that these situations are often portrayed in actual wilderness. Many of you know I'm not a big fan of the wilderness. I was talking about this to Rocky last night, or this morning rather. Rocky and Mickey were in the actual wilderness yesterday. I'm not a big fan of being in the wilderness. You don't know what's behind the trees, and you just don't know what's going on. Things are very ordered in the city, right? It's harder to see our need for things sometimes in the city. Things are very ordered. Our streets are laid out in grids, right? All the streets are named. All the buildings are numbered. We know where we're going. In the wilderness, not so much. For me, anyway. In the wilderness, we need to depend on something beyond ourselves. And we encounter wilderness situations. We've been talking about this recently in the face of the hurricanes, right, that assailed the Southeast U.S. and the Caribbean. And we saw that. We saw people facing something beyond themselves. What do we do in a case like that? We can evacuate, or we can nail everything down and hunker down and pray. We're facing something beyond ourselves. In a wilderness situation. And for the Israelites in our story, friends, the thing is about, as I said, survival. It's about life and death for them right now. They need water. They need water to survive. They can't go on very long without it. And so the two questions for the Israelites right now, living in this post-deliverance time that they're in, they have two questions. The first is, how are we going to survive? How are we going to live? And the second question is, how are we going to function as a people? How are we going to function? How are we to function as a people of God? How are we to function as a people who have been delivered? This is all the second question. I'm just putting it different ways. How are we to live? What have we been delivered for? What have we been delivered to do? And what defines us as a people of God? These are good questions. These are our questions, friends. These are the questions of our lives. And we're going to be looking at these questions over the next 6 weeks as we look at our second half of Exodus. So for this morning, we have this. Mara, bitter, 15:23, goes like that. When they came to Mara, they could not drink the water of Mara because it was bitter. That is why it was called Mara. Why does this say Mara so many times? The verse says Mara so many times for emphasis. The message couldn't be more clear, right? Sometimes we read something in the Bible and it's hard to figure out the meaning. We have to work at it. Sometimes it's a little easier. So let us not miss the meaning here. When they came to Marah, which meant bitter, when they came to bitter, they could not drink the water of bitter because it was bitter. That is why it was called bitter. And as Abby told Jenna, we're talking about bitterness today. The whole sermon was pretty much encapsulated in that. That was good. That was good. But let's not miss this, friends. It's been said that sometimes we find what we were not looking for. Sometimes we find what we were not looking for, and we call this serendipity. It's good. Sometimes we find what we were not looking for. Sometimes we find what we were not looking for, and we call that trouble and angst. And sometimes, friends, we can't find what we're looking for. And we call that disappointment bordering on hopelessness. Sometimes we can't find what we're looking for. They found water. They were looking for water, but it was bitter. And we don't know where Marah was. We don't know where Marah was. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly where it was. And I think this is a good thing because Marah is universal. Marah is not so much a place, friends. Marah is a circumstance. We're talking about a circumstance of life, facing something that is bitter. And I'll ask rhetorically, do you know what that tastes like? We know what that tastes like, right? And if we don't, we will. And following Christ, friends, doesn't equal every day a Friday. I would never stand up here and tell you that, because that would be a lie. It just doesn't. Scott Peck is the author. He's an American psychiatrist, Scott Peck. You might have heard of this book, The Road Less Traveled. Yeah. He wrote a book called The Road Less Traveled. The Road Less Traveled is the second best-selling nonfiction book of all time. I didn't know this. Interesting. The second best-selling nonfiction book of all time, The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. And this is how his book begins. These are the first words of his book. And maybe this is why it's so popular, because it's honest. Life is difficult. Three words start the book. Life is difficult. And friends, the Bible is just as searingly honest about our lives. When they came to bitter, they could not drink the water of bitter because it was bitter. We'll know bitterness in life. We'll know getting a call from a hospital. We'll know getting bad news. We know things like our families breaking apart, shattering. We know about things like things we've dreamed of and hoped for not happening that will never happen. Right? We know these things. We've known them and we'll know them. And the question for us is not so much why. We tend to ask why. It's just something we do. But I don't think this is the most pertinent question. And oftentimes there's no good answer. And as I always say, beware of anybody who wants to give you a glib or an easy answer as to why. I think, though, the better question for us in those cases is, on what are we going to base our lives in the face of this bitterness that faces us? When we are at Marah, the question for us is, on what are we going to base our lives? On what are we going to base our lives when we're in this howling wilderness waste? This is the question. And I've said before, friends, that Christ is not so much the answer. I think it was Kierkegaard who said that. Christ is not so much the answer as the decision. And I agree. Christ is the decision. This is what Christ himself said. John 12:31. Christ is on his way to the cross. This is John's lead up to Christ at the cross. John 12:31. Jesus says this. He says, "Now the judgment of the world is here. Now the judgment of the world is here." And that word for judgment is Greek. It's krisis. It's we get crisis from it, but it means decision. Like a judgment, right? Like a judgment is a decision. Did we get the judgment right? Jesus said, now the decision of the world is here. This is the decisive point of human history. This is the decisive decision. And this story, friends, that we're looking at always points forward to Christ. And when we think of Christ, we need to decide on what we're going to base our lives, because we want to base our lives on other things. We want to base our lives on ourselves. We want to base our lives on our own ability to control things. We look to base our lives on things outside ourselves that sometimes aren't very good for us. We distract ourselves endlessly. We try to work against this life is difficult line. We try to mitigate this line by making life as easy as possible for ourselves, by numbing ourselves and all the different ways that we numb ourselves, right? Because it's comfortable to be numb. And sometimes these things aren't very good for us. And this is a lot of bad news. And everybody's looking very glum, and I guess we should. But things are about to turn around. Seems that happens a lot. Things are about to turn around, though, because here's the thing. The story's not over. We're only in verse 23. And God is there, friends. And God has not left his people post-Red Sea. God did not deliver the people of Israel and say, okay, see you later. He's still there with them in the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day. God is there. The people of Israel have not only been delivered from something, they've been delivered for something. They've been delivered to something. We're talking about the two halves of Exodus. The first half we just finished. We talked about it as God's power, right? We call this whole thing power and presence. Power and presence, or deliverance and worship. God has shown his power. Now he's showing his presence. The Israelites have been delivered, and now they're going to be taught how to worship, and by extension, us. The people are complaining. The people of Israel are complaining. And I would say, quite rightly, they're complaining. I would complain too. They don't have water. And the text doesn't bring any judgment against the people of Israel here. They complained against Moses, it said. We don't have water because we need water. And they said, what shall we drink? What shall we drink? How are we going to live? How are we going to live? And Moses knew what to do. Moses knows what to do. What does he do? He cries out to the Lord. He cries out to the Lord. We talked about the Israelites at the beginning of Exodus. They had a bold voice for hurt. Remember the Israelites when they were in slavery and bondage under Egyptian oppression. They cried out to God. Remember, the word was like shriek. They shrieked out to God. We heard that God heard their cry. And we said that we need to be people with a bold voice for hurt. We should be people with a bold voice for hurt to God, for ourselves and for others. Because these people need to live. And they don't even know right now if it's possible. And Moses cried out to God. And I know I've been alluding to this howling wilderness wasteline. I've talked about it a couple of times this morning, and I kind of talk about it. The howling wilderness waste. What's he talking about, you might be saying? I didn't make up that phrase. It's from Deuteronomy 32. There it is. I love these verses. They're some of my favorite verses. It's talking about God and the people of Israel. He sustained him in a desert land. In a howling wilderness waste, he shielded him, cared for him, guarded him as the apple of his eye. I want to talk about that apple of his eye line just for a second, because I've talked about this before. You've heard this expression. The first time I heard it was when I was a kid. I heard Stevie Wonder's Sunshine of My Life. You are the sunshine of my life. You are the apple of my eye. I thought, what a nice thing to say. What does this mean? Why? How is this in the Bible? Well, it means you're something very precious. But it's interesting because this is written in Hebrew, The Hebrew idiom doesn't say apple of my eye, apple of his eye. It actually says little man of his eye. You know, when you're looking at somebody very closely and you can see yourself reflected in the pupil, right? The little man of the eye. So isn't that a great image? God guarded them. God guards us. God guards you as the apple of his eye. Imagine yourself seeing your reflection in God's eye and what that would look like. And how God is looking at you with so much love and so much grace and so much compassion and so much care. He guarded him as the apple of his eye. I love that. As the eagle stirs up his nest and hovers over its young, as it spreads its wings, takes them up and bears them aloft on its pinions, the Lord alone guided him. I told you it was going to get better. No foreign god was with him. Because we look for help from foreign gods. We look for healing in wrong places. It's what we do. And the Israelites will do that. God never leaves them. He never leaves us. He never forsakes them or us. And the Lord shows Moses what to do. And I love the line. God doesn't tell Moses, note. He doesn't say anything to Moses. It just says God showed him a branch. God showed him a piece of wood. That's it. It's like God's like, go use that. No, he doesn't even say anything. He's wood. The water becomes sweet. The water becomes sweet. They can drink it. And God brings healing. God has shown us what to do. Right? God has shown us what to do. I said that the questions that we're going to be asking ourselves of ourselves and of each other over these next 6 weeks are, how are we to live as delivered people? How are we to live as people who are taking part in, who are caught up in God's delivering work? What does this mean? What are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do? And there's a great line in Micah, a famous line from Micah 6:8 that says, he has shown you, mortal, what is good. Right? Act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. God has shown us what to do. And he's shown us, friends, in the person of his Son. And he enables this in us through the person of his Spirit. This is the good news. God guiding us, enabling us, strengthening us, calling us to participate in his delivering, saving, healing work. Calling us to take part in God's healing, delivering work. God calling us to make the water sweet or to make the lemonade sweet. This is what God does. And there's a great rabbinic section about this passage. There's a rabbinic writing about this passage that goes like this. It's about a conversation between Moses and God. Moses asked God why God created brackish water. Moses, well, why did you make this water in the first place, God? And God replied, instead of asking philosophical questions, why don't you go do something to make the water sweet? Isn't that good? Instead of philosophizing, why don't you go do something to make the water sweet? So let us take that to heart. Because there's people all around us at Mara. There's people in here at Mara, right? There's people all around us. Cry out to God on their behalf and do what we can to make the water sweet. It needn't be something very complicated. It could be something as well, it's not that simple, I guess, but making Thanksgiving dinner for a bunch of kids at a shelter, which your church just recently did for Thanksgiving. For some kids who don't have that much good experience of a home-cooked meal and a meal with people who care about them. When we take up offering in a few moments, you'll see a bunch of pictures on the screen. So if you're wondering what God is doing around here, in us and through us, to make bitter water sweet, just look at the screen. You'll see a bunch of examples, and we're thankful for these things. We're thankful. The people of Israel are reminded, we're finishing up here, the people of Israel are reminded at the end of this passage that they've been delivered to worship. They've been delivered to, delivered to enjoy God's presence. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about worshiping God. They've been delivered to enjoy God's presence. They've been delivered to obey, to listen, to take the time to listen, and to trust. And in this way, they're tested. And we read that this was a test. It's not so much a pass-fail test, but it's a way for their faith to be proved or trained. And the lesson here is that God is the bringer of life. God is the bringer of life. Water is life. Healing is life. God is the one who heals. And here it is in 15:26. He said, if you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and give heed to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians. And make no mistake here, this is not God threatening them. Okay? God is not threatening the Israelites. He's not saying do this or else. Because look at how the verse ends. I am the Lord who heals you. I am the Lord who heals you. The Israelites have been delivered to enjoy God's presence. The Israelites have been delivered to worship. The Israelites have been delivered to make God's ways known in the world. To be healed by God and to take part in God's healing work, which is nationwide and it's creation-wide. Someone described this command. It's like the difference between saying, if you obey the speeding laws, I will not give you a ticket. And if you obey the speeding laws, you'll be much safer. Do you see what I'm saying? God's saying, I've created you for this. This is life. The command is given out of concern and love and the desire to live. The desire that God has for us to live in communion with him. This is why the command is given. And this is why the commands that we're going to be reading about in the next few weeks are given. And friends, the enablement to follow them has come from Christ and comes every day from the power of the Spirit of God with us. Which is good, because as followers of Christ today, we kind of live in an in-between time, right? We live in an in-between time. We live beyond redemption, we live beyond the cross, but we await something that we call the consummation, which simply means that day when we hear the voice of God saying, look, I am making all things new. This is what we're waiting for. This is what we call our hope. When we talk about our Christian hope, this is what we wait for. This is what we await with eager anticipation and joy. But in the meantime, we're living in between. So we're kind of living in a kind of wilderness all the time. We sing in one of our hymns, we talk about treading the verge of Jordan, right? We say, when I tread the verge of Jordan, bid my anxious fears subside. This is the day we're looking forward to when we're going to no longer be in a wilderness. We're going to cross the Jordan. What a great image. In the meantime, we're in this threshold situation. But friends, this is nothing to be afraid of. It's nothing to feel badly about because God is with us and transformation happens. And it's not all Mara. Sometimes it's Elam. And this is what we read in verse 27. What a wonderful way for this passage to end. When they came to Elim, then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water. Isn't that good? 12 springs of good water. Why 12 springs? Not a rhetorical question. Anybody? Exactly. You know what that means? There was enough for everybody. And palms, palm trees, date palms. How nice. I like dates. Sit back and eat your dates and drink good water and rest. And if you don't like dates, it's fine. This is an image, so you can insert whatever you like, guacamole and lemonade or chicken wings, iced tea, pistachios, whatever. You'll remember that. You remember that this afternoon. That's good. Sometimes it's Elim, friends. This is where God leads us. It's not all Mara. I know I talked a lot about Mara and bitterness, and we're just being honest. But sometimes it's Elim. Thank God. One writer, okay, so you might, this is it. You might say, why can't it always be Elim? Why can't it always be like that? Yeah, that's a good question. One writer puts it like this, and I think this is a very good answer. I put this on the screen. I'll just let you read that for a sec. Often after the trials and tests of a Mara, God has an Elim prepared for his people. Dealing with nothing but Mara day after day would suck the life out of us. No kidding. No kidding. Dealing with nothing but Elim day after day would soften us and never stretch us. All the water in the day palms all the time. A healthy combination is, on the one hand, having our backs against the wall and learning to trust God. We've known that, right? And on the other hand, those days when we feel we're living on a mountain underneath a cloudless sky. Elim. So friends, no matter what our circumstance, be assured that God is with us, that God heals us, that God invites us into loving communion through the person of his Son and through the power and presence of his Spirit. And he guards us as the apple of his eye. And may God make these truths ever more clear to our hearts. Amen.